Scriptures. And now the reading. The reading is on page 1049. It's Luke chapter 16, chapter 15, beginning at verse 12. Good beginning at verse 11. The parable of the prodigal son. Jesus continued. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. Whilst he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and a sandal on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. Then his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Thank you so much, Rhoda. Chester, he also says, Rhoda stood up. Here we say thank you to Rhoda. If you've ever had a birthday card from the church, it's Rhoda who's organised all of that. So thank you, Rhoda. Now, you might be worrying, and Rhoda did ask me just to let you know, if you haven't had a birthday card, it might be because you didn't tell us and didn't want us to know your birthday. That's fine. But also, we've had a lot of people join since we first started that database. And with the new GDPR regulations, we're not allowed to renew it until we've sorted out our GDPR policy, which we haven't done yet. We're on our way to doing. So, if you haven't had a birthday card, blame GDPR. and probably in the new year, we'll be taking and renewing our whole church database. So if you like your birthday to be remembered and celebrated, do let us know. We'd love to do that. Right. Also, just while the money's there, that reminds me, a couple of weeks ago I asked if anyone would help with the gift aid reclaim, and I said that it was a lengthy process. Actually, I've done a little bit of work. It's quite a simple process, and all it is taking names from one spreadsheet and copying them over to a government one, and the other, and it takes about an hour, 2 hours. If you would like to do that to help us reclaim some gift aid, I can show you that in about 5-10 minutes, and that would be a great, great help. So come and see me afterwards. Now, on with the story, because it is a cracking story. Some people have said that story that Rhoda just read about the two sons is the finest short story in the history of literature. And it is a corker. It's a story about children and parents. And when you've been around children, you know that children reveal a lot about your character. I thought I was super parent. I thought that I was Mr. Child Psychology Development. I thought I knew exactly how our children were going to grow. They were going to go from one nurturing experience to another. And then I had children. And I realized, actually, I had a lot to learn. You know, before I had children, I used to really frown as a primary school teacher on parents who would put their children in front of the TV for a break. Then, not long into parenthood, I'm picking up the Thomas Tank DVD and thinking, 2 hours? 8 episodes? Fantastic! Get it in! So, there we go. But also, children can misunderstand their parents, can't they? Barack Obama was saying how one of the coolest presidents, whether you like his politics or not, arguably one of the coolest presidents of the US since JFK, was saying how his two teenage daughters, while he was president in the White House, thought he was a bit dull and a bit embarrassing. And that children think you're wonderful, don't they, when you're young, and then as you grow older, they think you can't do anything. But if you're in that period now, adults, hang on in there, because this is what Mark Twain said. He said, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much he had learned in just 7 years. There we go. So may Mark Twain's experience be yours. Well, let's have a look. With any story, you're meant to look at the characters, aren't you? Let's have a look at the two principal characters in here, the two sons. So let's look at the first son, the one who runs away and squanders all his possessions in wild living. We'll call him the bad son. And he sees no benefit in the father. Everything that's good lies beyond the father. He leaves the old man and the old religion alone. He goes to the distant country. He squanders his wealth in wild living, doesn't plan ahead, has no ties with morality, whatever feels good, do it. He doesn't seem to build long-term relationships, no lasting friendships from his time away, and no real relationship with his dad. And the bad son discovers life's lessons the hard way. No matter what you've been gifted, life is tough. There's been a series on the TV, hasn't it, about the Getty dynasty. The riches of the Getty family and what a miserable family life they had, even with all that money. And the son discovers that life is tough, and for this bad son it means feeding the pigs. And then we come to the good son. Well, everyone would think he is good. The second son, he's hardworking. Where do you find him first? He's in the field. He's working, he keeps the rules, I never disobeyed your orders, he says. He's committed, all these years I've worked for you. He's self-focused, he's planned. You know, when he realises they killed the fattened calf, you can read between the lines, he's thinking, hey, I was working for that. That fattened calf, that was for me. He's a little bit annoyed. While the first son doesn't build any relationships, the good son's relationships are all mechanical, aren't they? I've been working for you all these years. When the bad son returns, do you notice he says, this son of yours to the father? He doesn't say my brother, doesn't mention his name. It's quite a distant sort of relationship. You get the impression he's quite bitter, actually. I've been slaving all these years, and you never even gave me a young go. You know how it is when you have an argument, isn't it? It's always, you never, I always. It's never, well, sometimes, and occasionally, it's you never, I always. And which son are you most like? Are you like the bad son, impetuous, living your life for the high life, living for the moment? You have shallow relationships, everything that's good. You've got to be out there, away from God, away from Christianity, in a distant place, and you're going to find that place. You've gone chasing one good experience after another, and you haven't found, like Homer, what you're looking for, and now you're in trouble. Might not be that you're feeding the pigs, but you might be in trouble in some way. Life is not good. Or are you like the good son? You work hard, you keep the rules, then one day you'll get rewarded, you'll get that fattened calf, you're planned, you're organised. Hey, no one's going to catch you squandering anything. You wouldn't dream of risking anything or being lavish or excessive. Safety is your motto. You get angry, you wouldn't show it, but you get angry when other people get stuff that you don't feel they deserve, they should have. Get a bit annoyed about that. Why should they have such fun, you think, when you feel better and angry? Like the good son, you feel, I've been slaving away all these years and I've never got anything. Everyone else gets the good stuff, but not you. Actually, truth be known, you're a bit annoyed with God. You've been doing all this stuff for God. You've been keeping the rules. You haven't been messing around. What's God ever done for you? So much joy in life. What's God given you? You're a bit annoyed, a bit bitter. Actually, do you know you can be a bit annoyed with God even if you don't believe in him? So you might say, actually, God, I'm so annoyed with you because of what's happened in my life. I'm going to punish you. Do you know what I'm going to do, God? I'm going to tell you I don't believe in you. George Orwell, who was an atheist, and he wrote Animal Farm and 1994, described the bitter atheist, the sort of atheist who does not so much disbelieve in God as personally dislike him. I'm cross with you, God. You can be a Christian and be cross with God. You can be a non-Christian and be cross with God. But actually, do you know what's so interesting about the story? Do you know what this whole story turns on? It's not that the sons are different. It's actually they're both identical. Do you know there's more that connects the sons, there's more that's similar about them than different. Their similarities are fundamentally greater than their differences. You're thinking, how on earth is that true? Let me show you. Two things. First, both sons start well and end badly. Good son starts working hard in the fields, probably, yes, I'm going to get that fattened calf. Yes, my dad's going to love me. I'm going to do well. By the end of the story, he is an absolute misery. He's bitter, he's cantankerous, he's unpleasant. I would not want to meet him. The bad son's exactly the same. He starts well, he gets all the money. He gets 50% of the inheritance right there, right then. Don't know how much that would be if someone asked for the inheritance that was due from you, but I'm guessing it's quite a bit of money. Starts well, but then it goes badly, doesn't it? He's feeling the pigs. Both sons start well, finish badly. Okay, but there's a second similarity as well, even more fundamental. Both of them believe that their worth and their love from the father depends on what they've done. Both of them think that. The good son says, I've sinned, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. The good son, he says, all these years I've been slaving for you, you've never even given me a young goat. Both of them, the relationship is one of supply and demand, particularly actually with the good son, even more. It's even more marked with the good son. You can have been a believer in God for years, you can be a Christian for years, and actually you are like the good son. It's a relationship of supply and demand. Come on, God, I've been slaving for you all these years. What have you ever done for me? Do you know what happens in life? You tend to judge people as you look at yourself. If you're honest, you by and large think everyone's honest. If you're dishonest, by and large, you think everyone will be dishonest. They'll all be shafting you. Both sons judge the father according to themselves. God says, you thought I was altogether like you, but my ways are higher than your ways. This story, both sons reveal something, their actions reveal something about their father, but they also badly misunderstand. Let's see what the father's really like, shall we? Because the father's both similar to them and different. The father is the freest of them all. He's actually much freer than even the son who goes off and does his own thing. He gives his son inheritance. Would you do that? Would you do that? Would you break up what you've got and sell it? Wouldn't you worry? Wouldn't you say to the son, no, I'm not going to do that for you because I know it'll cause you pain. The father gives the son, the father gives us freedom of choice. He doesn't put barriers in the son's way. He doesn't spy on him. In another story, you'll see that Jesus talks about a shepherd going after the sheep. In this story, though, the father just keeps looking from a distance. He allows the son to live out his own choices. But the good son's actions also show how free the father is as well. He seemed to be a slave to the rules. So while commitment and hard work and obedience are important, there's even more important principles that Jesus talks about, like mercy, kindness, compassion. The father, do you love that bit? The father is full of compassion. The father's heart was full of compassion. He ran out to meet his son and kissed him. He knew if he did that, he'd be criticized by the other son. That's interesting, isn't it? But he was a free man. He let his heart guide him. He's also the most excessive of them all. You think of the bad son being excessive, the father's even more excessive. There's rings, there's fattened calves, there's robes, there's new footwear. If you know anything about the price of trainers, you'll know that's an expensive thing. His heart's full of compassion. He hugs his son, and his son is full of muck from the pigs. He's got no respectability. Desmond Tutu said the problem with God is he has such low standards. He loves everyone. And the good son shows how excessive the father's love is. The good son is measured, isn't it? Why have you killed the fattened calf there? He's never done anything. He squandered all the money on prostitutes. And God says, yeah, but he was lost. And now he's found, he's there, but now he's alive. The father's just excessively loving. You see, his love doesn't depend on what either son's done. It doesn't depend on deeds. The good son discovers that he's loved purely for who he is. And the bad son discovers the same thing. You know, the good son began trying to earn his father's love through supplying hard work and being committed and being a slave. But God says, you're always with me and everything I have is yours. Before you were formed in the womb, I knew you. How could I forget you? Even if a mother forgot a child, how could I forget you? The bad son, the cartoon, I love those cartoons, but it just got it slightly wrong. The bad son, if you look at the story, doesn't even get his speech out. You know, the little speech, he says, I'm gonna be less than a servant. I'll be a servant, I won't be a son. Because the father just loves him, between arms around, a big bear hug. And so what about you, what about us as a church? You know, my guess is more of you will be feeling like the good son than the bad son. Hardworking, diligent, shin-filled. I've been in other churches where my guess would be most of the congregation would be feeling like the bad son. I would guess for us, most of us would be more where the good son is than the bad son. Hey, I worked hard, God. Where's all the good things you promised me? I didn't do that, and I did do that. But God is not like that at all. You see, what's interesting is right at the start of that story, you notice who's gathering around to hear Jesus. It's the tax collectors and the sinners, the bad guys of society, whoever you think the bad guys are. They're gathering around. The good people, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they also gather around, but they're muttering. If you go back to Luke 15, chapter 1, they're muttering. You know, Jesus had this amazing ability to attract the bad people and repel the good people. Bad people, if Jesus is really present, are instantly attracted to him. Why? Because they know he loves them. He's not judging them. Good people, who think they're good, are repelled by Jesus. Jesus annoys them. Why? Hey, they've been working up good deeds for years. Jesus suddenly says, one, you're not as good as you think you are. Two, you don't have to do all that stuff to love me. They've got the most to lose. The bad people just come to Jesus. If Jesus is really here, this place will smell both foul and fragrant. It will smell foul because there'll be foul people here. There'll be people here who do things wrong. And that's you, and that's me. And the moment you think you're a good person, that's the moment you start smelling foul. Because no one's good like Jesus. You've never loved like Jesus. You've never embraced people like Jesus. You've never given away all your worldly possessions like Jesus did. You're nothing like him. You smell absolutely foul to God. And if you're sitting there thinking, you know, this is a gathering of all the good people, you've got it totally wrong. This is a gathering of all the foul people in life. You're amongst smelly people. But then you see the fragrance of Jesus comes in. The fouler people know that they smell, the more fragrant of Jesus. Have you ever got on the tube and gone, that smells nice? Some of it's really nice, like expensive aftershave on a really expensive perfume. It fills the whole carriage, doesn't it? It fills the whole carriage really nice. That's what Jesus begins to do. You see, the fouler you think you smell, the more you're willing to let Jesus come in and fill up your life. You say, hey God, I haven't made it. I've got it wrong in all sorts of ways. And I need your help. Please help me. And Jesus says, yes, I'm there. And he just fills that gap. And you know, then there's a feast. Because Jesus provides the feast. And it's excessively lavish. And if it's the place where Jesus is really present, we'll be excessively lavish and generous and unrespectable in the best way. And do you want, let me just encourage you as well. I think in many ways there's many signs of the presence of God. Just sorting out the budget at the moment. The church is pretty free with its money. You are pretty free with your money. You give quite a lot away. We often have services where we don't take anything from the money that's given. It's given away. And the church gives away quite a lot. Thousands. You're quite happy for us to use what we have to support others in need. That's really good. We really love Catherine for sorting out the big quiz. Just a wonderful thing to do. People are coming to support that. And when we care for people who we don't know, when we love people who don't love us, when we do that and we know we might be criticised, that's when we know Jesus is around. Are we saying we're perfect? No, of course we're not. If you're a guest here thinking, oh, the pastor thinks the church is perfect. One, he knows how imperfect he is. Two, he also knows how imperfect everybody else is. And we're not saying that, but I do want to encourage you that there's many signs of the excessive love of Jesus here. That's why you and I are going to be spending a lot of time at Christmas trying to tell people about who Jesus is. And not worrying about the cost of it. But the more Jesus is here, in the very best sense, we'll be less careful and less respectable and more loving. I'm not saying just absolutely ridiculous. But you see what I mean? And sometimes you might be criticised for that. Jesus was criticised for being excessively loving. It's funny, isn't it? No one found anything wrong with Jesus, but they all found something to criticise him for. And then we come to the feast here. Let me just move this. This is the feast. This is Jesus. He's given everything for you. He's not held anything back for you. You don't have to come to this table being perfect. You come to this table being imperfect. In fact, there's no room for people who think they're perfect. Because this is Jesus' table. And if you think you're perfect, you won't have any room for Jesus because Jesus came for the imperfect. And you might say to me, Nathan, this was meant to be all about forgiveness. Today you haven't mentioned forgiveness once, but then you realize the whole thing's about forgiveness. Once you realize how forgiven you are, once you realize how foul you smell to God, once you realize actually there's nothing I can do to make God love me, He's just forgiven me, He died for me, He's taken all my badness onto Himself, and He's living again in me, you'll want to forgive other people. You won't be able to help yourself forgiving other people. Love keeps no record of wrongs. We keep record of wrongs when we want to get up on someone, don't we? So I might keep a record of Sally Ann's wrongs, so I can just prove myself a little bit better. I might have a few bullets in my gun, so when we have an argument, I can whip them out. You never do. Ding, ding, ding. I always ding, 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 because I miss the path. But because if I love someone, I'm not going to keep any record of wrongs. Why? Because like the Father, I'm looking for reconciliation. What's my game? My game is loving people. My game is being reconciled to them. I can't make them receive forgiveness. The Father didn't go out and grab the Son back. That's not your job. Your job is just to be not keeping a record of wrongs. Okay, I mean, we don't go confront sometimes and sort things out, but that's not coming from the basis of keeping a record of wrongs. That's a loving confrontation, working things out so a relationship gets better. Just let them go. Friendship, marriage, relationship, work relations. Thank you for record of wrongs. Just be open and loving. Today, it's not excessive in sense that, you know, no one can call that an excessive amount of grapes. No one can call that an excessive amount of food. But what it symbolises is the deepest of excess. The love that Jesus poured out for you. And what I want you to do is to celebrate as you drink and eat today. I want you to know that you're really deeply loved. My sense is that God wants you to know just how deeply you're loved. That's really the simple message today. There ain't nothing you can do to earn His love. Just enjoy it this morning. Just know that you're loved. I'm going to ask Kevin and Jackie if they would be kind enough to come and help serve communion. Let me pray, and I'll tell you how this all works. Jesus, thank you that you've given everything for us. Jesus, thank you that you are so fragrant and so lavish. And I pray this morning as we take communion that your people here would know how wide and deep and high and long is your love. Amen. Let's just take a moment before we take this. If there is anything you want to get straight with God, anything you want to ask for His forgiveness for, let's do that in the quietness of our hearts, knowing that Jesus loves to forgive. Jesus, we are here, foul smelling, made fragrant by you. Lord, in the quietness now, will you, if there's anything we want to get straight with you, anything we want to say sorry for, I pray as we confess that in the quietness of our mind that you will forgive.